It's a new year. What are all the new rules? Melissa in the Morning is here to explain now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Well, it's been the one that you've been talking about probably the most over the last couple of years. And at 10 o'clock in the morning on January 10th, adult use recreational marijuana sales began here in Connecticut. And joining us this morning to talk all about it is Michelle Siegel. We welcome her to the show for the first time, Commissioner of the Department of Consumer Protection. Good morning, Michelle. Thanks for being here.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, first of all, Michelle, how long have you been the commissioner?
I've been the commissioner for almost 6 years now, and before that I was the deputy commissioner. So I've been with the department for probably just over 11 years.
Okay, so you are by far one of the most perfect people we could talk to about this. I mean, you kind of watched this sort of unfold. You know, you watched the legislation come into debate, you watched the debates happen, and then it got approval. And now here we are, where we've slowly, over the last year and a half, we were slowly making marijuana more and more legal. And here we are kind of at the final step where it's legal to now sell them, retail sales. So tell us just about that process, if you don't mind, just, you know, where it sort of started and how we are today here in Connecticut.
Yeah, so the state's been thinking about marijuana policy for quite a long time, as you suggested, and it started with the medical marijuana program, which was shortly after I joined the department. So we're probably talking 10 to 11 years ago, medical marijuana became legal, and the Department of Consumer Protection stood up that program. Then for many years, there was some discussion, sometimes some proposals legislatively to legalize it for all adults, everyone 21 and over. And so finally, a couple of years ago, that passed, and the Department of Consumer Protection was again tasked with standing up that program in that marketplace. And so it's been a process. Although the law passed over a year ago, there was a lot of time needed to create the licensing infrastructure, let people apply, issue the licenses, and businesses themselves need time to hire and stand up their businesses. So we were excited after all this discussion and then work to a couple weeks ago open up the market. There is now a safe place for people who do want to use this product. And of course, we always tell people be responsible, but for adults to go and buy the product and have some confidence as to what they're getting in a really safe and legal way.
Does the Department of Consumer Protection feel that Connecticut did this in a good way? And I want to make sure listeners know that I'm not looking from a political standpoint, because I know there are a lot of opinions on it. That's not why Michelle is here this morning. I don't really want to get into if we think it's a good idea that it's here or it's not. I just want to know from the department standpoint if Connecticut handled the rollout the best that we could.
I think the state did a really good job with it, and I'm really proud of the team at the Department of Consumer Protection who worked incredibly hard. And there was a lot that was built into this. And, you know, besides just creating a marketplace to sort of address and take a look at what has the war on drugs, what have been the consequences of that, and are there ways to correct that as well? And so social equity was a big piece of it in Connecticut. Both through a social equity council, and the department has also spent a lot of time thinking and working through those issues as well. But I think the state's been very thoughtful in how it's done it, and I am incredibly proud to be part of the team at DCP that stood up this marketplace.
And I've noticed, too, that there are towns and cities still that have moratoriums in place, you know, like talking about being thoughtful and really making sure that everyone is doing what is best for themselves and you know, their constituents. It seems like even the option that, you know, for example, I look at Fairfield, their moratorium is up around this time next month. So the fact is this passed, we knew it was coming and the rollout was going to take around 2 years. And they're just kind of coming back to the table to say, hey, do we even extend this longer or do we start to put rules in place? So it does feel that there was enough openness of, hey, we're going to do this, but we're going to take our time and make sure we do it right to support what you're saying. It does seem that the state did that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was a lot of consideration and respect for the different sort of viewpoints that exist. There's a lot of towns and municipalities throughout the state, and they all have different views on the appropriateness of this product in their community. So some were excited for the opportunity, you know, could create new businesses and jobs and right, you know, right in their community. There's, you know, some tax revenue benefits to towns that have these businesses. But others felt like they weren't quite ready and needed to spend some more time studying it and thinking about this. And we saw that with the medical program as well. When that was initially passed, a lot of towns had moratoriums. But one thing I think the department did well is created a program that really was cognizant of the concerns of communities. And we saw over time, more and more towns did start to loosen their restrictions and allow these businesses to open up. And I'm hopeful and confident that with the adult use market as well, once people see how this is and that the businesses are responsible corporate citizens, that more and more towns will be open to having these types of businesses in their communities.
Commissioner Siegel, I'm just curious because we talked about if things went well. Is there anything from the Department of Consumer Protection standpoint that could have been improved or that we maybe missed the mark on with this?
I think based on the law that was passed and the task put forward to the department, the team there, we did a great job. And there's definitely people who have concerns and that were, you know, at the start of a legislative session. And so there are a number of ideas people have as to how things can be improved or changed. And I think that's a healthy conversation. A lot of it, it would involve changing the law and providing more policy guidance from that legislative branch perspective as to how the program should be. But based on the law as it was written and sort of the task presented to consumer protection, I think we really followed the spirit and letter of the law in that regard. And, you know, there is a marketplace. It's opened and it's been running smoothly.
Yeah, because I think what you're referring, maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I know that there are some lawmakers right now saying let's halt where we're at until there's a state drug recognition expert certification program up and running. I'm not too familiar with what that program is. I mean, I can understand just from the title of it what that means, but I wasn't even aware that that was supposed to coincide with the rollout of marijuana. I don't know if it ever was, but I know that that's sort of a discussion on do we halt where we're at. But it doesn't sound like that was really something in the game plan originally, or was it?
It certainly wasn't something for the department. I mean, I think there's always been issues and it's always been part of the conversation around legalizing this or what are, you know, are the concerns if people misuse, if people are driving while they're under the influence. And so I think those concerns persist and it's certainly healthy for people to discuss should there be more done on that end. There is a separate agency that deals with mental health and addiction services that would probably be more focused on those issues. But the state, including, you know, that agency, have put out a lot of materials and done a lot of work around reminding people how safe use, safe storage. There's really strict packaging and labeling rules for the products that are out there, and those are built into the regulations the department, DCP, put out there for the businesses. So these products have to be in childproof packaging. They need to be labeled, reminding people that you shouldn't drive under the influence, that these have, you know, can have effects, including delayed side effects and could be intoxicating, et cetera. So there's a lot of rules already in place to address that. And so whether they need to be stricter or whether there needs to be more on the end to assist people who maybe do develop a dependence is certainly a healthy conversation for there to be.
We have the distinct pleasure of having Commissioner Michelle Siegel of the Department of Consumer Protection here talking about marijuana retail sales, and that rolled out just a couple of weeks ago. So, Michelle, take us inside of the, like, one of the shops, what people can experience if they've never been in one before or if they were previously getting their marijuana from other states, for example, where it was legal. What do the shops look like here? One of the ones I get compared to a lot is the one in Springfield, Massachusetts, for example. Is it similar to that, or what does it look like when you go to one of the Connecticut shops?
I think you'll see a lot of similarities. You know, these are definitely very professional. A lot of them have sort of, you know, it's hard to describe, but a sort of like holistic sort of, but a very clean environment. But I think people who have gone to Massachusetts may find some similarities. An important piece of our program in the initial businesses that open were already serving medical patients. So you'll probably go in and you'll see a place for medical patients to line up and a separate place for adult users. There's, you know, really pushing online ordering. So there's, you know, at least certainly in the opening days would be have tablets and other things so people could go through, see what the inventory looks like, place their orders, and that really keeps the flow moving. So you're not standing in line for a super long time or stuck at the counter trying to figure it out then. But I think people will be pleased, particularly if they're somewhat new to the product.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Michelle, but there are currently 7 shops open right now, another 2 on the way, right?
Yeah, that's true. And there's more coming, you know, following those. So we'll see over the course of 2023 a variety of new businesses opening, including some that came through the social equity process.
Okay. The reason I asked that was you kind of hinted at what I was going to go to, which is how many could we potentially see open up? And maybe we don't have that number. But like I noticed earlier this week in the news that Stanford just got approved for a second adult use pot shop. So I wasn't sure if we could potentially see, you know, more than the 9 that have already gotten approved and we know are either open today or are going to be opening in the next few weeks.
I think definitely. So the Stanford one, as you mentioned, is really coming up right behind the other 2 that were approved right at opening day. A lot of it, we will approve a business and we certainly do a final inspection before they open when we feel like, all right, they have both in the paperwork and we visited, they're set up in a way. There's some security and other requirements that meet our requirements. And if that's all in place, we will tell them that they're approved to open. There is work they still have to do. So it may be we think they're in great shape, but they still needed the zoning approval. They may still need to hire up their staff. They need to do, may have other work they need to do to set up their business. There may be still some more cosmetic construction that doesn't touch on our requirements that need to happen. So some of it is out of our control once we tell them you're good to go. They need to on the business end decide. But I would expect, certainly, you know, businesses aren't going to sit on their hands. They want to get open. They want to come to market. So I would expect over the coming months, we'll see several more. And certainly there could be a few dozen throughout the year.
Are they growing on their property or nearby? Like, where are they getting their cannabis?
No, so that is separate, and there's a separate kind of licensing structure. So there were 4 large growers that were already supplying the medical market, and they, in anticipation of the adult use market, expanded their ability to supply the market. So they're providing supply. There's also several pathways for people to get in a license to become we call them cultivators. So either a cultivator or a micro-cultivator, which is just a smaller cultivation business. So there's a number of businesses that are following that pathway and will also be opening up over the coming months, you know, certainly 2023, maybe into 2024. So more supply will be coming available through that process as well. But these are all separate businesses and they're not going to be attached, really. The retail business is separate. And, you know, those may be in whether it's a strip mall or other areas where consumers go, where as opposed to the growing facilities, which are often in larger warehouse type spaces that are generally not sort of sitting in those commercial districts.
Another question, Michelle, does the Department of Consumer Protection, do they do like random checks for either the stores or even cultivators like we see for restaurants when you have somebody come through or even at like a convenience store to make sure they're not selling to underage drinkers? Like, are there random checks that are done for both shops or cultivators?
So the cultivators don't sell to consumers, so that they're really just kind of in the wholesale side.
Right, they're working more of the business. Okay, yep. Yeah.
Yep, but no, certainly inspections is something that we will be doing. We would take complaints. We would need to. So there's a variety of ways, but as this gets up, we're certainly monitoring what's going on and keeping an eye on things. And we're going to be standing up a way to do both scheduled inspections, but also ones that may be a bit more random, so that there's opportunity to see things. And of course, we'll need to react if we get complaints, whether it's from consumers themselves or if local law enforcement alerts us. And it's similar, we regulate the liquor industry, so we similarly need to deal with issues there where somebody's selling to underage people. And we have a variety of ways that we try to identify when that's happening and address it.
Well, Michelle Siegel, you are a joy to talk to, Commissioner of Department of Consumer Protection. I appreciate your time and for coming on this morning to talk to us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You're welcome back anytime. Again, Commissioner Michelle Siegel of the Department of Consumer Protection. And if you want to learn more, there are certainly plenty of resources. If you go to portal.ct.gov/cannabis, you can find things on there, including what's actually in effect, the medical program, licensing, the Social Equity Council, statistics, documents, everything you would want, you could find there on that website. Again, portal.ct.gov/cannabis. And again, thank you to Michelle Siegel for taking the time to come on WICC. I know we typically do news around the region here, but we have pushed that by a half hour because of scheduling. I'm very excited this morning to have Dr. Olivia Bigas-Didem here, who's a migraine specialist for Hartford Healthcare. And there are two reasons I wanted to have Dr. Bigas-Didem here. And one of them is because you may have seen the story earlier this week, Tori Spelling, very well known in Hollywood, an actress, revealing that her daughter, Stella, came home from the hospital after suffering from a hemiplegic migraine, which I'm not too familiar with, so I wanted to understand that. But also, in general, migraine therapies, because many of you have experienced that. I know even people in my own family suffer from migraines. So I'm very excited to have on the show this morning Dr. Olivia Bigas-Didem. Good morning to you, Doc. Thanks for being here.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Melissa. Thank you so much for covering such important topics. And as you mentioned, migraine hits 1 in 4 households, so I'm sure everybody is affecting in one way or the other.
1 in 4 adults in the U.S. are impacted by migraines?
1 in 4 households. About 12% of adults, but 1 in 4 households, like families.
Oh, households. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Okay. So 1 in 4 households are impacted. That's still a very significant number of people and many people impacted. So yeah, I think migraines, a very common issue and something that people want to talk about. Let's start with the Tori Spelling story, if you don't mind, Dr. Bigas-Didem. Mm-hmm. What is a hemiplegic migraine? I don't even know if I'm saying that correctly, but what is that?
Yeah, you're saying it perfectly. It's a very rare type of migraine disease. It affects about 1 in 10,000 people. And on top of having a headache, there are different symptoms. So to meet the diagnosis of hemiplegic migraine, there needs to be motor weakness on one side. So one side of the body is weak. And usually there's a progression of symptoms. So during a hemiplegic migraine attack, people start with vision changes, zigzag lights, flashing lights in their vision or part of the vision they don't see, and then the tingling pins and needles starting from their hand to their arm to their face, and then they have weakness on one side. They can have speech difficulties afterwards. Some people after also feel dizzy or imbalanced. Then there's a headache. About half of people, it's a genetic disease, it's familial. So they have a mom, a dad, a sibling, or a grandparent with it. And about half of people, they don't have a family history of it.
It almost sounds like a stroke.
Yeah, and that's why it's scary. I think it also brings the notion here because it's the actress' daughter, right? The anxiety for the family and for the parents, and probably the feeling of helplessness and scare when it happens. So strokes are not stereotypical. So people don't keep having the same symptoms each time they have a stroke. So once you have a diagnosis of hemiplegic migraine, you start to understand what attacks look like for you. But this has to be taken seriously. The first time you have those symptoms, you have to call 911, go to the emergency room and get evaluated to make sure it's not a stroke or something else. And even when you have a diagnosis of hemiplegic migraine, if you have different symptoms than usually, if things feel longer, again, you also need to get urgent medical workup to make sure it's not a stroke, a seizure, or anything like that.
So we're talking this morning to Dr. Olivia Bigas-Didem, and we're talking about the story that Tori Spelling, a 49-year-old actress, shared about her 14-year-old daughter, Stella, who suffered from a hemiplegic migraine. Pretty rare to get it, but a condition that pretty much impacts one side of the body. And it's similar to what you would think is a stroke, which is why so many people worry about it. How do you get this type of a migraine? Like, what could have triggered this?
Yeah, sometimes we know the triggers and sometimes we don't know, but big triggers is acute stress, bright light, intense emotion, sleep disturbance, like you skip a night of sleep or your sleep schedule is off, exercising a lot, mild traumatic brain injuries. Those are some of the main triggers.
Wow. I mean, and again, I know you said this is pretty rare, but 14 years yeah. old, she's very young.
Actually, we most she's the typical age for the start.
Oh,
we
really?
The adolescent. Yeah, it usually starts. I mean, the range where it can start can be younger children to later in life, but most people it would start between 12 and 17 years old.
Wow.
Often, with time, the attacks become less frequent. And then after 50 years old, a lot of people, it transform, or they may still have some migraine attack, but they don't have the weakness on one side. So actually, 14 years old is a typical age for this.
So once you experience this, wouldn't call it an experience, once you suffer from this, can you get it again, or is it like a one and done?
Yeah, so hemiplegic migraine, unfortunately, it's a chronic disease. So you are likely to have other attacks coming, yes.
But is there something like at home you could do so when you know you're having one of these attacks that that's what's happening? Or do you always have to go to the hospital to get to get the care you need?
Yeah, not necessarily. So there are plans in place. And this plan, there's different things. There are medication you can take daily to reduce the frequency, the severity, the duration of the attack. So that's what we call preventive treatment. There are medications you can take as soon as this happens to try to decrease also the severity and the duration. But it tends to be the same attacks, so people tend to recognize them. So in a sense, that's reassuring. But if it lasts longer, if there are new symptoms that were not there before, you need to get evaluated for that. And then some people, unfortunately, also if the symptoms are too severe, it's not breaking with medication by mouth, like pills you take at home, then you go to the hospital for intravenous treatment, which would be stronger.
Okay.
And also part of the treatment, I think it's educating the family, making sure that the school knows, for school accommodations, a whole support system in place, because it's hard for the patient and it's hard for the family.
Yeah, no question. Dr. Olivia Bigas-Didem, who's with Hartford HealthCare, a migraine specialist. So what causes a migraine, Dr. Bigas-Didem? Like, how do migraines happen?
Yeah, so migraine is a genetic disorder. So you either have a predisposition, a sensitivity to having migraine, or you don't. Because it's a misconception that, oh, you caused your migraine. Nobody caused the migraine. It's a disease. Like, there is asthma, and people have asthma attacks. And that makes your brain hypersensitive to things like stress, weather changes, and sometimes things build up, and you can have a migraine attack.
So is that something that you could, even if it's genetic, is it something you could develop in your adult years? Like, I've heard of people who never had issues with migraines, and then they became young adults, 20s and 30s, and all of a sudden they have chronic migraines.
Yeah, and usually that's the peak. Most people start with migraine attacks around their college years and young adult. In the U.S., the most highest proportion of migraine attack is for women in their 30s. And part of it is, we think, is hormonal. That's why it hits in early adulthood, and then most women see an improvement after menopause.
So are there different therapies that could treat a migraine? I've heard of people using Botox in the back of their neck. Like, I've heard of things like that, but I didn't know what therapies are currently being used to treat migraines.
Yes, so we have a lot of therapies, and we have medications, and we also have non-medication therapies, but there's two main classes of medication therapies. The one you take as needed, as soon as you feel the migraine attack coming, you take it. Everybody with migraine needs to have some as needed treatment. And then there's preventive treatment you take on a regular basis to decrease the frequency, severity, duration of attacks and improve your function during attacks. Botox injection for the prevention of migraine, it's 31 injections, so it's more than in the neck. It's also in the face, on the side of the face. Usually we try medications before going to Botox. We do it every 3 months in the office. It's well tolerated, which is great. You know, there's always a downside with potential side effects. And Botox is only approved for people with very frequent migraine attacks.
Wow, and 31 injections when you go to get that done. That's pretty wild. What do you think about?
It's pretty quick, but a lot, yeah.
Right. Well, I have somebody who I used to work with at one of my old stations. She got frequent migraines. I mean, you know, sometimes even twice a day, every day. So she started to get Botox, but I didn't really ask her too many questions about it. But I just thought, wow. So I've heard of that being done, but Yeah, it's good to know that that's kind of more of like a last resort, just because that sounds like it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to have that done.
And when people have such severe migraine attacks, they're ready to do anything,
right?
Really, because it's so disabling. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so debilitating for sure. So we're talking to Dr. Olivia Bigas-Didem, migraine specialist for Hartford Healthcare. And what about, are there vitamins or supplements even to prevent having migraines or to better your chances of migraines not being as brutal as they can be?
Yes. So the one with the most evidence for migraine is riboflavin, which is vitamin B2. We like to say 400 milligrams once daily. That being said, this usually comes in 100 milligram capsules. So I tell people, whatever you can take, it's better than nothing. Or some people open the capsule and dissolve it in water, or they just get a powder. It makes your urine fluorescent yellow, which is not dangerous, but it's also with very minimal side effect profile. For people with migraine with aura, we also recommend magnesium between 250 to 400 milligram daily, and there are different types of magnesium. So we are talking about magnesium oxide, gluconate, glycinate, aspartate.
So B2 and magnesium, those would be the two you'd recommend.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, I think this is very pertinent information. Is there anything, do you know if they're working on, because I know constantly behind closed doors, there's a lot going on in the labs across the country, but do you know if there is a, you know, like a potential cure on the horizon? Is there anything or a better remedy on the way? Any sort of insight into that?
I mean, cure will be wonderful, but we are not there yet. So the best thing we have right now is increased understanding of the mechanism of migraine. And because of this increased understanding, for example, the CGRP molecule was found, which is a molecule involved in migraine attack. And because of that discovery, now there's been actually six preventive medication on two acute medication that came to the market, and another one should come soon with that mechanism. So when more is understood of migraine pathophysiology, of migraine mechanism, then more drugs are being developed which are more effective, more targeted, with less side effect profile. There's been an increasing number of molecules that have been found, so hopefully this leads to new treatments. The biggest advances are in genetics, to try to understand what genes are involved, and when we know people's genes, can we predict what patients will respond to what medication? So that's also another thing underway right now.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Olivia Bigas-Didem, I want to thank you again for getting up early, coming on the show, sharing all of this information with us, and I look forward to speaking to you again in the future. Thank you again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Bigas-Didem, who's a migraine specialist for Hartford Healthcare right here on WICC. Welcoming back to the show this morning, Gary Fallon, who is an employment attorney for Mitchell and Sheehan in Stratford and also a professor at Quinnipiac University. Good morning, Gary. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. I think we've got a couple of scenarios that I'm happy you're going to talk about this morning, because it may ring true for some of our listeners. Age discrimination in the workplace. Do you mind just giving us a recent scenario you've seen and what people can take away from it?
Well, I think we're starting to see more and more people working longer, choosing not to work. Because for many reasons. One, financial. Secondly, because they enjoy what they do, and they feel like they're contributing. That's sort of, you know, somewhat coming in conflict, though, with employers who sometimes believe that when somebody gets older, either, you know, they're slowing down, or it's time for them to retire. I just recently, you know, I met with a client the other day who is, after a long career, the employer just said, you're 64, and you're going to be retiring this year. You know, it's an important decision for people, but more and more the decision to retire is not being made by the individuals, being made by the employer.
Well, and what an interesting thing to say, because a lot of people are realizing that they, first of all, financially cannot retire. So it's kind of interesting for even a company to put that on someone when you don't necessarily know their personal, you know, their financial records or anything like that. But is that sort of does that come down to the technological advances we're seeing and the need for Gen Z millennial workers? Like, why are we starting to see sort of the shove for 65 plus?
Well, part of it, you know, I think we'll see. You were mentioning before, just before the interview, about the news stories about layoffs. Inevitably, when there are layoffs, there's a disproportionate number of older workers who are affected, because they generally are making more money, and therefore they seem to get hit in a disproportionate manner. But again, at the core of issues surrounding age discrimination are assumptions that people who are older are slower, they're forgetful. So many stereotypes involving age discrimination that's sort of kind of pervasive in today's workplace.
So another thing too, Gary, that I'm noticing is if you are not sort of forced into retirement, that people get their salaries cut. They're like, hey, you know, we'd love to keep you as a valued member, but we can't justify continuing to pay you at X amount. So what if we give you 60%, 50% of what you were making, and you sort of become a different role, but you're still employed there, almost justifying, you know, why you're still there. Have you seen that scenario play out?
Absolutely. And I think sometimes, and I recently had another, you know, client where this occurred, and the employer's perception or sort of explanation was, I'm doing you a favor. I'm enabling you to have more free time. Not really recognizing the fact that a 50% pay cut you know, might it not have been in that you know, their year's budgeting planning, and that may not be something, you know, that they want. You know, but we're seeing more and more, and there's more of a discussion in this society. And I think it's really going to, particularly if Joe Biden decides to run for re-election as it is anticipated, more and more of discussion is, you know, how old is too old for a variety of jobs. It was, you know, a fascinating article in the New York Times on December 24th about the Tom Brady of other jobs, talking about other, you know, people in occupations, anything from like 70 to, you know, 95, who are continuing to work and who love what they're doing. I think employers lose a whole lot of valuable knowledge, experience, mentoring of younger workers when they had just assumed somebody's over the hill because, you know, they hit an arbitrary number.
I agree. And we're talking to Gary Fallon this morning, who's an employment attorney for Mitchell & Sheehan, about age discrimination and what we're seeing in some workplaces. And I think you sort of started to get at what I was going to ask about, Gary, which is, are there certain works, certain industries, if you will, lines of work where, I don't want to say it's appropriate, because that's not the right word I'm looking for, where it's necessary, so like to start saying that people are aging out of a job. So for example, like you bring up Tom Brady, which is a great example. Excuse me. Because Tom Brady, in his almost mid 40s right now, when you look at some of these players who are 23, 24, 25 years old, they're sort of being told, "Hey, listen, if you get one more concussion, you're out." Like, I look at the quarterback for the Miami Dolphins, who's young, upcoming, has a lot of talent, but had 3 concussions this past season and was told, you know what, if it were up to us, the doctors, we'd tell you to retire. And he is going to, you know, he'll try again next year, but he very well could lose out on the 20 years that Tom Brady got to do. And I think you sort of run that risk of, okay, if we're telling 25-year-olds that they probably cannot continue on because of the dangers, the risks for their health, how do you justify a 43-year-old continuing in that role and the bigger risks he faces if he gets knocked to the ground? I mean, do you feel that there is any kind of leverage there to say, hey, you know, it's sort of contradictory? I don't know if I'm saying something that's offensive, but I'm just asking, you know, I'm trying to understand if there is such a thing as aging out of a certain job.
Well, I don't think so much aging out of a job. For example, what you mentioned, that regardless of, you know, the Miami Dolphins quarterback, whether he was, 23 or 43, 3 concussions in a season is a medical reason where you need to reevaluate. That has really nothing to do with age. Problem is, and if you assume, you know, that age has a factor, unless it relates to the, you know, to the ability to perform the job. And that's why, for example, I'm going to be speaking on a panel at Quinnipiac Law School on February 15th. The topic is, you know, whether or not cognitive exams for doctors at age 65, is it necessary or is it discrimination? That sort of thing, I think we're going to start to see in other occupations, whether it be lawyers, teachers, as more and more people continue to work beyond 65. I mean, for example, 1 of every 8 doctors in America is over the age of 65. That just kind of illustrates that, people are working longer. That said, there are certain occupations where you need to, you know, perhaps, particularly due to public safety concerns, where there has to be, you might want to be able to assess them to make sure that they are still able to do the job, but you have to do it in a lawful manner.
I want to talk about that a little bit more, especially, you know, to your first example of, you know, President Joe Biden and some of the claims that have come out, especially from the, you know, people who are not a big fan of him as a leader and his cognitive struggles, cognitive abilities. Is it appropriate or is it kind of unlawful discrimination at the workplace? It's a discussion we're having with Gary Phelan, who's an employment attorney at Mitchell & Sheehan, also a professor up at Quinnipiac University. And I know, Gary, you're going to be speaking on this at the Quinnipiac Law School on February 15th, the idea of testing cognitive abilities. You know, it's interesting because I look at President Joe Biden and when he was running for office and even while he is currently serving, one of the points I think that he gets hit on a lot is when it seems that his mind is slipping or he misspeaks or he loses train of thought. And you know, and it's interesting because, you know, no matter which side of the aisle you're on, for both former President Donald Trump and even the current president, Joe Biden, a lot of discussion, especially if you're a millennial or you're a Gen X, a lot of the discussion has been, can we please get a younger president? Can we get someone who's under the age of 60, like a 45 to 55 year old who is, you know, is experienced, isn't so young, but also, you know, hasn't started to lose their mind a little bit. And I don't like using that term, but I know we're tight on time. So do you think there are certain lines of work where it is appropriate, as you mentioned, because it's impacting people's lives, a huge population of people's lives? Like, what do you think? And not just for a president, but, you know, for politicians, like you said, for doctors, for law enforcement, for, you know, for firefighters, for teachers. I mean, the media. I mean, shouldn't we be checking if we have our cognitive selves together in the media? Like, I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Well, I think if there are behaviors that lead to, you know, to have concerns about ability to perform the job, then, you know, that's where it may be appropriate. But that applies to all ages, not just people who are older. And that's what one of the problems is if something like this cognitive test is just sort of an arbitrary number, and we're going to assume that after that point you have to prove there's not a problem.
So more consistent testing. It shouldn't be an age. Like the idea of, I know police would love to see people get retested for their driver's license every 10 years. I agree with that. I love the idea of retesting for your driver's license. We have nurses retest for their license. We have health insurance agents do that. And, you know, in the human brain forget, like, we get into a routine. We don't remember as sharply as we did in our 16-year-old classes. So you're talking about, if you're going to do cognitive testing, do not make it an age thing. Make it a mandatory, hey, we have to make sure that you know, if you want to enter this position or if you want to continue in this position, no matter what age you are, that you're being tested for that. Am I correct in what you're saying?
Yes, it still has to be done that's consistent with the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, it's like the ADA is very much intertwined with age discrimination in a lot of ways. So as long as it's done in a way that's appropriate, but across the board, not just singling out a separate group of older people, then it's more likely pass legal muster. But part of it, you know, I think part of the problem is, again, there's not metrics. Tom Brady, if his performance declines, you're going to see it in the numbers. Most professions don't lend themselves to that, you know, where you can that sort of metrics where you can measure whether the performance. Though that's where the problems come into play. But again, that someone may still be able to do the job, even though as they're older, they may manifest some sorts of behaviors, that might sort of are consistent with the stereotypes involving older workers.
That's really interesting. Well, Gary, I know you're probably going to be back on, if not before, right around the time that you talk about this in length at Quinnipiac Law School on February 15th. Would love to have you back on the show, whether it's to talk about this on a deeper level, maybe even hear what some of the panel discussion was about. I would love to get some feedback on this because, I think it's something that, as you mentioned, unfortunately is very prevalent in today's world in a lot of workplaces. And it's something that we have to tackle and do a much better job of handling. So I'd love to have you back on the show to talk about it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, Gary Fallon, always appreciate you. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll talk soon. All right, Gary Fallon again, who is an employment attorney over at Mitchell & Sheehan in Stratford, and also talks about law over at Quinnipiac University. He's a professor there, and we always welcome his advice and just some of his insight on these types of cases here in Connecticut on WICC. So thank you again so much, Gary.